The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Discretionary time for the last few days has been filled getting ready to go away for a month. A lot of, I couldn't believe how many details there were to take care of. And and there's still a couple. But I'm leaving right after the potluck. I'm going and to long drive to spend 3 weeks in the wilderness teaching kind of a Buddhist wilderness retreat, and then to recover from that. I don't think I need to recover, but the contrast is that then I'm going to go for a week backpacking with my wife. So 4 weeks in the wilderness. And so I come here wonderfully empty of Dharma talks. So if any of you have any questions you'd like to ask about anything that seems somewhat related to what we're about here at IMC, our practice or teaching or something, I'd be very happy to respond in some way.
Good morning, Gil. I just have I guess it's more of a personal question, if you're open to answering. I'm just curious how your practice has evolved over time in terms of when you first kind of got interested in it, and then what's changed, what's stayed the same?
Okay, so a little bit, trying to do it short. I guess it's been 50 years to to summarize here. And so certainly I've suffered less. Suffering's what brought me it didn't bring me into Buddhism. I got interested for other reasons, but at some point, when I was about 20, I started getting interested in Buddhism when I was about 19. But it was a little more intellectual. But when I was 22, I suffered enough that I thought, okay, I have to kind of deal with the suffering. And then that suffering has abated, sometimes in big steps, quantum steps, sometimes a slow, gradual process. And so one way my practice has changed over the years, it feels lighter. There's an ease to the practice or a lightness to it. Another thing that's changed is that I think what so things that this practice did to me, very important things that it did, this less and less suffering, sense of ease, it came with a decreasing of clinging, of a being caught or attachment. So there's been a steady decrease of that. And I'd like to believe that in that process, there were three phases that happened. The first phase was that compassion was awakened in me, and that became a central organizing principle for how to live my life. The second was that loving kindness was awoken in me, and that changed my way I related to myself and to other people. That made it a little bit lighter than compassion is. Not the compassion didn't go, but it opened up a whole different way of appreciating people in a very deep way. And the third phase was it opened up a third kind of social emotion that I call care. The Pali word is anukampa, which was I very strongly associated with the absence of clinging, the absence of stress or tightness. And so when compassion, loving kindness, kind of meet non-clinging, then it can come through in this very simple, easeful kind of way of really having a profound sense of care that's different than compassion, different than love. But it's in some ways I feel it's like the foundation for it. So that was a third phase. So, is that to answer the question well enough? You could be next, Nancy.
Gil, just in the last week, it has percolated to the top of my mind that I don't really understand, or haven't really understood, what Vipassana means.
Vipassana.
And is Vipassana what we do here? Uh-huh. And does the meaning of Vipassana intersect with or relate to the meaning of mindfulness and uh-huh. the differences between yeah. mindfulness and concentration. That's kind of a 2 or 3 part yeah. question, but just answer yeah. whatever seems yeah. most useful.
Yeah, I appreciate that question very much, because I think it has been confusing about all the different ways the word vipassana is used and insight and mindfulness is used. And so to get some clarity about it rather than just one big jumble, assuming they're kind of the same, but doesn't seem quite right or something. So the original meaning for the word vipassana is that it was not that it was a practice people did, but rather it was insight people had in doing the practice. It refers to insight, and so the meaning of the word pasana of vipassana means to see. So it's a particular kind of seeing. So that is so insight. It kind of works because the sight is in seeing, you know. And the V is just a emphatic prefix. So you can choose how you like to emphasize. You should say it strongly, seeing. Or you can say, you know, really seeing. Some of my teachers, or my favorite translation is clear seeing, to give that emphasis. And then the question is, what do we see? And the ancient tradition is very clear what you see. And that this is to see the inconstancy, the changing nature of our experience in some very profound way that you can't imagine if you're seeing the change in the world, which is, you can see change all the time, but there's a different way of experiencing the changing nature of the way that perception works when the mind is concentrated, when the mindfulness is really clear. So the word mindfulness, sati, refers to the nature of awareness that has the ability to see clearly. So for the Buddha, sati was never a practice people did, but it was a consequence of doing practice. So in the modern world, these things have become practices. So like, come time see and practice mindfulness, people will say. And yes, we're doing vipassana here. So what's happened is over time is these insights have been starting to be seen as, be identified with the practices that lead to the insight, to lead to this clear awareness, clear sati. And some of those things are the ability to know clearly. So the recognition of the present moment experience is not the same thing as sati, the original meaning of mindfulness, but it's become the meaning of mindfulness. And then the people who do that clear recognition of the present moment, then that's sometimes called vipassana practice. And kind of we don't use the word vipassana here too much to refer to ourselves. We use the word insight, and a little bit of it is not that, just because it's English, I guess, one reason, and because when the American teachers who started this particular lineage that we're in, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, they used insight to describe their first meditation center, Insight Meditation Society. And so then different places call themselves insight to associate themselves with that. So insight is a little bit like a brand name that, you know, but maybe it's a better word or association name for people connected in this kind of lineage. And then there's a different lineage that uses the word vipassana centers. And people say, I just came back from a 10-day vipassana retreat. Its chances are 99% that they were doing a Goenka retreat, which is wonderful. But they're different. They practice a little differently. Our practice and their practice has the same goal, but the means to it is different. So there is a difference. And the same goal, meaning the same insight, the same insights into inconstancy. I didn't finish it before. Something called not-self. And something called suffering. dukkha. So you see those in a deep way. So they and the Vipassana people, Goenka people, practice this, to have the same deep insight, but they could get there a little different ways. And so is that enough?
That was a lot.
That was a lot, I know. I apologize. So Nancy had her hand up before, so
thank you.
Pass it forward here, please.
Good morning. Okay. Good morning, Gil. I have a question about something I've been exploring some in my own work and teaching, which is something I was inspired to explore, actually, from my activities here. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the connection between beauty and ethical mind states.
The connection between beauty and ethical mind states. So every 3 years or so, I teach a year-long course here on ethics. There's what's called three trainings in Buddhism. There's the training in ethics, the training in meditation, and training in wisdom. And they're all equally important. And so I do a year-long course on each of those. So in 2025, I'll start with the ethics again. But the first thing that we read for that course is an essay on beauty. And because beauty, the word for beauty that's being, one of the words for beauty that I'm referring to in Pali, is also means being what in English we call ethics. It turns out there's no good Pali word, believe it or not, ancient Buddhist word, that represents the English word ethics. There was one of the first Western professors of Buddhist ethics was really amazed when he started trying to study ethics in Buddhism, and he couldn't find any like books or doctrines or treatises or philosophies of ethics, teachings of ethics, like he had been used to in Western theological studies. You know, there's departments of ethics, for example, in some places, and so I think he has an article called something like "Morality Without Ethics," and then he describes how historically this word ethics was somehow, because of Western cultural reasons, was kind of became its own special thing. In Buddhism, ethics was not separated from the whole enterprise of Buddhism. From Western point of view, the whole enterprise of Buddhism is ethical. From the beginning all the way to enlightenment, enlightenment is an ethical experience. But it's not kind of called that, it's just called Dharma. It's just called Dharma practice, so you have to kind of read read more carefully to see that every step along the way, there's an ethical quality to it, and one of the characteristics of this kind of ethical quality is that it's a natural consequence of the mind's or the heart's beauty, and to cultivate this beauty, to discover this inner beauty, this wholesomeness, this sense of is synonymous with cultivating an ethical sensitivity, which in Buddhism is defined as inseparable from ethics in Buddhism is defined as that which avoids causing harm, but instead causes benefit. It's that easy. So that's the whole domain of Buddhist idea of ethics. And of course, it can get complicated. How to analyze that in different circumstances, but that orientation to not causing harm is considered in Buddhism as profoundly beautiful. And I've met people, you really clearly feel that that's their orientation, and I think they're just beautiful people, the inner beauty. Sometimes I've met people who it seems like this person's incapable of telling a lie. And so it just, just kind of you can feel it in them. And I said, wow, that's so beautiful and so wonderful. So rather than shaking my finger at you, Nancy, say you should be ethical, I'll just smile at you and say, let us see your beauty, your inner beauty. That would serve the world well. So someone back there outside had a hand that I saw before. So let's see if we can.
Bring that up. Thank you. I think at this time in the world, I don't want to go into detail, but in our country, some people feel a responsibility for addressing a potentially very dangerous situation for our country as a whole. And when I think about this, I remember Martin Luther King crossing the Pettus Bridge. He was leading lots of people in a civil rights protest. He was in the front of the line. He was addressed by people making violent threats, and he surprised people because he knelt in prayer. In the middle of the march, he just knelt down and started to pray. I wondered if you had any help for people in that the kind of situation I think some of us find ourselves in right now, in terms of meditation or some practice we could do that would help us right now. Thank you.
Well, I think all the Buddhist practice is a preparation for that capacity. And I say that because that was really the first reason why I got interested in Buddhism, was not my suffering, but rather was to be able to step into exactly those kinds of situations and not be afraid of dying, because it's a risky, right?
Yeah.
Someone is I'm dedicated to nonviolence action, so it's not pacifism in the sense of not doing anything, but rather you have to show up, but to do it nonviolently. And I could see when I was 20 that how important that was for me, but that I didn't know if I could do it because I felt afraid of potential death that would come. Mm-hmm. And I thought Buddhism had the answer to that issue of fear of death. Mm-hmm. And that in terms of how I've been changed, I'm not afraid of death now. I don't particularly want to die.
Yeah.
And, I'll be careful with how I drive and things like that. I have, in a certain way, a kind of a positive orientation to dying. Mm-hmm. If I could die, if I'm lucky enough to die consciously, because I imagine that it's very much like a process of the deepest meditation you go into. And so the idea, oh, that'd be cool. But more specifically, what you can do, so all of Buddhist practice is this. So to meditate, to practice, and know your own mind well, so that if you get afraid, if you get angry in a situation like that, it doesn't take you over. Uh-huh. That you know how to stay balanced, equanimous. You know how to stay peaceful, no matter what's coming your way. That you're able to stand there and look someone in the eye. As you know, there's someone that we know that was at the riots in San Francisco State University. It's called San Francisco State College, back in the Vietnam War, and was up against a riot police and looking, pressed up against him and looked him in his eye and was changed for the rest of her life by that. What she saw, the humanity of that person, Blanche Hartman. Tells that story often. And I've known someone who was in the civil rights South and was literally 3 days in a row was beat up by the same white racist in a protest for 2 days. Mm-hmm. And then the third day, the same guy came to beat her up and he had his fist up in the air to strike her again. And he looked her in the eyes and he stopped and he said, "What are you doing here?" And then they had a conversation, and there was no more violence. So to have that ability is phenomenal, to know yourself well. And then one of the classic Buddhist prayers that we would do is we would rely on loving-kindness, loving-kindness meditation. And so our equivalent, perhaps, of stopping to pray is to wish the enemy, wish our people who are fighting against or fighting against us, wish them well, cultivate goodwill and spread that goodwill.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Gil.
So you can bring it. We have another mic, but that helps sometimes. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, you can keep it over there in the back end in case someone else over there wants.
All right, this question is going to seem really trivial after all that, but when I was first taught to meditate, I was taught that one should reflect on one's intention before sitting down to meditate. I never understood that question.
So,
and I And I also was conscious of not wanting anything for meditation.
Yes. So.
I would. So ever since, I say my intention is to sit and meditate.
Right.
I don't know if I've misinterpreted that or if I'm.
So when you say that, when you establish that intention at the beginning of the meditation, does that support your meditation?
I think so, but then I wonder, should I just not even bother doing that?
So one of the answers to these kinds of questions is find the answer for yourself. And okay. What I asked you was the way to find it. Did it help your meditation to establish the intention to meditate at the beginning?
I think so, but then every time I wonder.
You're supposed to have a better intention.
Okay.
So, right? You wonder if there's the right intention. Maybe there's supposed to be something grand.
I just always reflect back to that, and I said, I don't understand this question.
Oh. Yeah. When I first started meditating, as I said, I did because I was suffering. And at some point, the kind of surface suffering that I had been trying to address kind of dissolved. And I attribute it to the meditation I was doing. And so the reason for why I was meditating was no longer there. But the really weird thing was, for me, was that I continued to meditate. And I like to do things for reasons. I'm kind of a little bit, logical or rational or something, maybe. And so I thought, this is really strange. I'm meditating for no reason. And why am I doing this? And I was doing it twice a day. I was a college student, undergraduate. There's other things to do if you're an undergraduate. And so every morning and every evening I meditated. And why am I doing this? And so I had that question for a long time. But I still kept meditating. So for now, I'll stop for a moment and say, that's one answer. You don't have to have an intention. You can just do it anyway. Maybe something inside, deep inside, knows that this is what you're doing. You want to do this. There's no question, which was my case. Eventually, what I realized was that I was meditating as a form of self-expression, not as something to attain. And I associated with the way that an artist might paint or dancer might dance as a form of expression. It's not about finishing something or accomplishing anything. It's the very act of itself. And that became really important orientation for me for meditation. The intention wasn't any more than just to let this inner expressivity flow through me that was deeper than words, deeper than my emotions, really a deep thing. Some people give that instructions to connect to your intention at the beginning of a retreat, the beginning of a sitting, because then people have give a little bit more sense of focus on the practice. Otherwise, we're sitting there and thinking about what should I have for lunch? my boss yelled at me yesterday and I really need to come back with a better rejoinder tomorrow. And, that might be important. But it's maybe meditation is more important, and so to be reminded. Oh, this my intention is to really sit and be focused and be here, and so that kind of lets the extra stuff fall away, and we're more here to do it. If it doesn't happen, if that doesn't help you, you're more than welcome to drop it. There's no shoulds in this practice. The only should would be for you to learn how to be your own teacher in the practice. So by trial and error, find out what works for you, what doesn't work. But it does help if you have it in some kind of sense of why you're practicing and what you're practicing for. And so what I like to do, and I don't want to mess you up even more, one of the great exercises, I think, is to ask yourself, I did it for a year every day, ask yourself the question, what is your deepest intention? What is your deepest sense of purpose? What's your deepest sense of meaning that you have? And what was great to do it over a year was I started going through all these different answers. And I had one answer, and then the next day it would somehow support me to go a little bit further. Sometimes I had negative answers, like, I don't want to be afraid anymore. That's my intention. But if it's negative, then I'd ask myself, well, Gil, if you were not afraid, what would your intention then be? And that would drop me into a deeper place. And it would change over time. It was really great. But then I think this question is so, our lives are so important, so valuable, that if you're answering that question for yourself and you don't see how meditation relates to that, maybe you shouldn't meditate.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Is that okay answer? Yeah. Also pretty lengthy.
Yeah. Questions from the audience?
Oh, yes.
So we got two online questions. I'll ask first Pat Howie's question. How is Dharma attended to in personal relationships, especially family and intimate others, like wives and children?
I think that in these relationships, there's a higher degree connection, emotional connection. There's a higher degree of, whether we know it or not, there's a higher degree of impact, what we do, and benefit that can come from the relationship. I think one of the things Buddhist practice does is for us to appreciate the primacy of those relationships, or the depth of those relationships, or the potentiality of those relationships. And for Buddhists, what I like to believe is that when we have these kind of more primary relationships, that to always discover how to love the other, to always be able to find, you know, something like love or compassion or care. And at different times, different ones will be operating. But my belief is that, at least I'll say it for myself, at some point in my Buddhist practice, I felt it was possible to find a way to love everyone. And it was only then that I felt inspired or something, or not inspired was not the right word, but I felt I could get behind being married. Because I thought, this is the person I want to always discover where I can find the love, no matter what happens. Yes, we'll grow separate, and yes, we'll have different things that happen and all kinds of things, but I want to always. I know love can be universal, and I always want to come with this person. I have committed to always coming and finding it. So I think to have that a primary characteristic of the relationship means that we're dedicated to not letting anything interfere with the clarity and the openness of the relationship. So we don't let hate or anger or resentment or envy, or we don't let greed or expectations or lust or projecting our needs or our values onto the other, because all those things makes the water muddy. We want to have this clear seeing or a clear space in every relationship we're in, and so that takes a lot of self work, you know, to really recognize, okay, now I'm resentful, now I'm angry. I guess I have work to do. Now this is part of my practice. And even if you can't let go of the anger or the fear or the hostility or the resentment, or sometimes the worst that can happen to someone is they shut down. They close their heart to some other people. I have no anger. Yes, but your heart's closed. And so the part of the purpose of mindfulness and practice in Buddhism is to always bring enough attention to yourself to really see where the tension is, where the stress is, where we shut down, where the unwholesome, non-beautiful parts of the heart are taking predominance, and to not believe in it, not trust in it, not prioritize it, not give into it. And that might not automatically help us to love other people, but if we try to jump over to the love before we do this inner work, the love might not be so genuine. So in Buddhism, at least, always this deeper look here, this is my work. And as soon as you say, this is my work, then you're starting to become free from being caught in some of the ways that we get attached in relationships. And with deep primary relationships, the attachments sometimes are the very deepest ones we have. And so the stakes are pretty high in these relationships, because if you're really going to let go fully, oh, that's scary in these relationships. I mean, I can't let go of that. But Buddhism says you can. And the reason you can is that the love, the compassion, the care, the respect, and maybe the commitment remains. That doesn't have to go away when there's no attachment. In fact, I'd like to believe that the love is actually better when we've let go fully. So I don't know if that answered the question for Howie, but that's my best effort.
Thank you. One more question from Jamie Andrews. Is there a connection between non-self and emptiness? Are they from different traditions?
Oh. Well, thank you, Jamie. I remember you fondly from the many times you sat here in this room. So, yes and no. There are the way that these ideas of emptiness and not self are taught varies in different Buddhist traditions. And there's one school of Buddhism called Mahayana Buddhism, which is the Buddhism of kind of East Asia, especially Tibet and East Asia. And they made a specialty around the philosophy and the practice and the insights of emptiness. So they go to town to talk about all the different forms of emptiness. And when you spend 2,000 years with the philosophy of emptiness, you can imagine that it's varied and rich. And if you want to, you could spend a lifetime as a Buddhist scholar digging into the different teachings on emptiness. But in the earliest form of Buddhism, it's there as well. But in our tradition, there's a connection to emptiness and there's a number of connections between emptiness and not-self. And one of them is that everything, the insight, this vipassana that we have, the deep insight, the clear seeing, at some point, we don't have to believe in this, we don't have to understand it philosophically or read a book to understand it, but it's something that becomes obvious. It's revealed to the eyes in a completely obvious way. Nothing could be clearer as the practice deepens. That nothing in our world of our experience, everything in the world of our experience is absent of self. So, of course, for many people, that's outrageous. I mean, do I disappear? Do I not exist? What goes on here? And so, you're just fine. but there isn't this coagulation around a concept, ideas around self. Even the very simple feeling of emptiness, I am, if there's a feeling for that in Buddhism, they say, well, that's not quite free yet. There's a very little constellation of emptiness we feel. Even when that dissolves, that's freedom. But you're still there. You're still, fine. So I don't know if that answers Jamie's question well enough, but maybe that's... enigmatic enough to spark your curiosity around this topic. So there's a question way back in the outer hall. Can we pass it back there? And oh, sorry about that, Kurt. You can ask afterwards.
Thanks, Gil. You spoke a lot about kind of suffering.
Can you turn it up the volume a little bit?
I think you spoke a lot about suffering being a motivation for...
If you hold it horizontally...
There we go. Okay. I guess you spoke a lot about suffering being a motivation, and I think that's something that deeply resonates. For where I am in my practice, I feel a lot of sadness still. And so I want to ask if you have any, can talk to more about kind of how to, what can be supportive for practice when there's still a lot of sadness for kind of the sufferings going on and what's
great
around us.
Great, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, with there is an ancient teaching in Buddhism idea that everyone comes to Buddhism because of suffering. Not everyone realizes that, but in one way or other people come that. And then the suffering has to take some flavor. 31 flavors of suffering. And so I have tremendous value. I really appreciate very much someone coming up and just saying, matter-of-factly, my flavor is sadness. You know, this is because it has to be something. But be so clear about it and open about it, I think you're well on your way to finding your way with it. So thank you. And the first thing that occurred to me, and I don't know if it's particular to something I'm understanding about you, just with a question, or maybe it's just me, maybe, that the first thing I would like to say is, be a sad Buddha. And I say that in the sense that a sad Buddha means don't try to fix it or make it different or feel bad about yourself for being sad. It's sadness. Sadness often needs time. It needs to have to be allowed to be there. And many people don't know how to let sadness be there. I mean, they know they're sad, but then they're adding layers of reactivity on top of it. I shouldn't be sad. I'm wrong, but I'm sad. I mean, after all, I'm a Buddhist. I'm supposed to be always smiling and loving. And, you know, but I'm now a bad Buddhist because I'm sad. So there's layers of things that we do. Or just might feel so uncomfortable, the body tenses up. Or you might feel so discouraged because whatever reason. And so this idea of just being a sad Buddha is to find a way to just allow it to be there. And then what we do in mindfulness practice is once we can learn how to be very simple, make space for it, allow it to be there as if it has permission to be there, then we can begin maybe seeing it more clearly. Find out, not to understand it, to analyze it, but to really get more deeply familiar. What's the roots of it in our body? How does it play out in the body? And part of the benefit of feeling emotions like this in the body is the body is a processing center that works much better than the mind. And so it's a kind of way of getting out of the way, helping you to get out of the way of the emotions so the motion part of emotions can operate. It can be in moving. And all emotions want to move. So even sadness wants to do something. And what's sometimes these more painful emotions, before they can heal or become better or do what they need to do, they need to be stronger. So then the practice is, if you have enough practice, you start having confidence. It's okay. I have the ability to be present, to be with it as it gets stronger and hold it, be a sad Buddha. So I have a lot of respect for sadness. I think sadness is something really important inside of us. My idea about sadness is that the harbinger of something that wants to be born inside. And what is it that wants to be born? So the ability to just allow it to be there, give it permission to be there, to look out deeper, see what else is there. And sometimes sadness, underneath sadness, might be hurt. And so maybe the hurt needs more time. Sometimes below that hurt might be love. And maybe that love now has a chance to grow and inform how we relate to the challenges we've been in. Or maybe, sadness and depression sometimes are not so different. And we have a culture, I think, now in the West that I think has developed a very negative attitude towards depression. That somehow it's wrong and you should fix it as soon as you can, antidepressant medication. And sometimes depression and sadness is a kind of I think of it as a little bit of as a fallow time. That something wants to work through us, something new wants to come. And sometimes we need to give ourselves the time, quality time, in being sad, being depressed, just to see if there's something else that wants to come that we're missing out on. And if we don't give that, some people, they don't give themselves that time, and they rush into what's next, what they think they should be doing, something kind of lingers deep inside that remains unresolved. So anyway, I'm just talking a lot today. But is that enough, or you want to ask another question? Because it's an important question, so if there's something more specific.
I'll digest that more, and then I feel like there are...
And some other time we can talk more.
Yeah, if there are other questions.
Well, maybe we're almost ready to stop. Maybe, Kurt, if you think my answer can be short.
Well, I'm not sure about your answer being short, but my question is this, and I have to say that all that you've been talking about today have sort of been answers towards my question I'm about to ask, but maybe you could elaborate even further. My question is this, given the political nature, and I'm going to use words like Trump and Biden, so forgive me, everybody. Or don't. But here's my question. I am experiencing, and I know a lot of people are experiencing a lot of fear, anxiety, judgment, and rage and anger. Okay, so I find myself filled with all of those things with respect to this fellow Donald Trump. And I am fearing, given the last debate, I fear that he has a good chance to win. So my question is this, Gil. Can you give some words and thoughts to how one like myself can respond if, in fact, he wins? But even if he doesn't, just I am so judgmental and fearful and resentful, all these things. So you get it. So are there any more thoughts you can give to how one, like myself, like I, can respond to these possibilities? And I know part of it's my future projecting, but anyway, that's my question. So, real short answer, please.
Yeah. I think one of the huge issues in the world these days, but also in this country here, is not political. It's hate. And fear. And the kind of divisiveness that comes from that in all directions. And if there's going to be a solution that's really going to be valuable, there has to be some deep addressing of this issue of divisiveness and hate. And that work can only happen at the individual level. So it needs to start with you. And if you're so mesmerized, so enamored, so obsessed with what's happening out there, you're actually missing yourself in a profound way. And probably the more that you're concerned out there, the more there's a need for you to really drop down deep inside of yourself to see what's really going on for you. There's probably some form of suffering in you that's actually primary, that's responsible for this orientation and that's external, and this expectation that the answer is out there, and someone is supposed to fix it. But the real issue is hate, and that's divisiveness and the fear. You do your work, and in the meantime, while you're doing that, if you're really concerned about any kind of world situations strong enough, part of people, one of the reasons that people feel like what you're doing is they feel helpless. Do something. Do something, anything at all, that addresses what you're most concerned with, even if it's very small, licking stamps, which no one needs anymore. And so that's the... Hopefully it's short, because you know, my answer was supposed to be short. I want it to be penetrating for you. I hope it did. Thank you. Okay. So now that we have deep insight, we have love, we have non-attachment, we're ready to do the practice, we have... either do or do not have a good intention to keep practicing. let's bring it all to bear for potluck. You're all welcome to stay. It's very nice, whether you brought something or not. And maybe because it's a potluck, if you'd be willing to take even 2 minutes to say hello to two people next to you and introduce yourself briefly, and then we need a little bit of time to set up the last of the potluck stuff. So, and if you don't want to even stay for that, that's fine. But it's nice to say hello and maybe say something about what we talked about today.